News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Hopefully you're a regular listener to the show and you already know what it's all about. Every week we visit with veterans of World War II. The harsh reality is that they're leaving us quickly. But people were telling me that 5 or 6 years ago when I started interviewing veterans, and there's still plenty of stories out there that have not been told. The story you'll hear today has not been told too often unless you've tracked down the book Nazi POW 2458. We'll tell you how to get that book from Don Miller, who's going to be 88 years old this coming week on Tuesday. He'll celebrate his birthday. August 2nd is getting a lot of headlines this year, but for Don Miller, it's just going to be his 88th birthday. And there was a time where he didn't know if he'd see his 21st birthday or his 22nd birthday. So we're going to hear about the story of a former prisoner of war in the European theater during World War II. But as you know, I like to start out with each guest a little earlier than that. We like to go back to December 7th, 1941, a day that changed America's future, and a day that every American who was alive then seems to have a memory of. So, Mr. Miller, where were you on December 7th, 1941, and how do you remember finding out that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor?
I had graduated from high school in 1941 in June, and my uncle helped me get a job at Hazel Atlas Glass Factory in Oakland, California. It was on B Street, I think, or G, maybe. And I was probably walking home from work. I worked graveyard in the early shift on there, and I probably heard it by the time I got home or just before I left. It was awful scary, and we thought the world was coming to an end.
And being right there in the Bay Area, certainly you're around the shipyards, you're around some targets that would seem to be relevant for the Japanese, and there were some fears up and down the West Coast that you may see some attacks on California. Was that something that seemed real to you at the time?
Well, at one point, I was walking home from Hazel Atlas home, which was about 6 blocks or 7 blocks, and everything was blacked out. And later we heard that there was a Japanese plane that had come over San Francisco. One plane is all, and it was only a rumor. We didn't know if it was true or not, but it was a blackout in the Bay Area.
Right, and everyone took part in that because the fear was so real at that time. So I guess that would be kind of hard to find your way home in Oakland with no lights on anywhere.
Well, I used to walk down the middle of the street because I didn't know what was on either side of the road behind the bushes and cars and stuff. I'd walk down the middle of the street getting home and get home about 12:30.
Well, we know you made it home, and we also know you made it home from the war, but that was no easy feat, and it certainly threw some curveballs at you that you never saw coming when you ended up in the Air Corps. Tell me that story. How did you become a radio operator and gunner on a B-24?
Well, I was drafted. I was going to go in with my buddy into the service. He went into the Navy, so I just thought, I'll wait and see when I get the letter. Well, I got a letter. I had to report down. And they sent me up to Presidio, Monterey, and we got our hair shaved off and the whole trip, even the 22-mile walk, march, we called it, with the blisters and everything. The shoes didn't fit, and it was awful. We shipped out to Biloxi, Mississippi, and I had basic training there at the air base in Biloxi. And they needed different people for air crews. And we took a lot of tests and did a lot of things like that. And I was picked to go to a radio school. I had no choice. It depended on what they wanted most to be trained. And I guess they picked me for the radio. I don't know exactly why, but that's what happened.
Was that something you enjoyed, or were you wishing that they would let you fly the plane or have some other position on the crew, or did you like being a radio op?
I had no idea. The only thing I knew about radio was the crystal sets used to make just to get KGO and the different stations around the Bay Area. But that's all I knew about it. So we were shipped up to Scotts Field, Illinois, a big air base there not too far from St. Louis. And we had like 20, 22 weeks of training there, nothing but radio, CD, which is Morse code, and radio mechanic. We just did that 24 hours a day, practically.
Now, how did that compare to what you'd been doing in the glass factory? Was it harder work? Was it more rewarding, more exciting, or how would you describe that?
It was mostly metal. We had to build a super heterodyne receiver, and before we graduated from scratch, have it working for the instructor. And then we did Morse code just so it drove you crazy. We were called Dit-Da Boys.
Now, I've talked to a lot of guys who worked with Morse code, and some of them say they've forgotten everything they've ever learned about it. Others
well,
of them,
I
it sticks with
I can remember my
them.
Name is about it, and I know that did-da-da-da, did-da-did is S-O-S.
Uh-huh.
That's about all I remember.
Well, I'm guessing your day-to-day life does not require too much communication using Morse code.
I guess that's pretty well out nowadays.
Back then, though, is a very big part of your job, and sooner or later you found out that you were going to have a crew to work with, and you were going to get to be aboard what some have not so affectionately dubbed a flying anvil, a B-24 Liberator. What was your first impression of that plane?
I had no knowledge of B-24s or any airplanes. Except when I used to go to the Oakland Airport, the old airport, we'd see these airplanes coming in, but nothing military. And when I first saw these planes, actually, I never really saw a plane up close until we went to El Paso, the Biggsfield down there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were assigned to a B-24. I mean, there was nothing but B-24s down there. I couldn't believe it.
When you looked at it the first time, did you say, that thing's supposed to fly?
Yeah, you can wonder how it even got off the ground. Now you look at these big airplanes today, and they're 10 times that big, it looks like.
So for our listeners, describe your duties, where you sat on the B-24, and how you understood at that time what your duties were supposed to be on that bomber crew.
I was in charge of all the communications, and I had a desk. And I had my liaison set and all of my radio stuff right there at my fingertips, right behind the co-pilot. That's on the flight deck. Flight deck is up a little higher than the rest of the plane. And you had to, when you got in, you had to crawl up into the flight deck. So that's where I sat a lot of the time.
But you probably also had to be familiar with the gunner positions on that plane.
Well, the top turret, the Martin top, turret had two 50 caliber machine guns in it, and the engineer of our crew, that was his turret. And I had to go back in the, behind the bomb bays, in the back of the bomb bays, and fly the right window gun. That's a one signal 50 caliber machine gun with a 3-rad radio sight.
Did you have much experience in B-24s before you actually shipped overseas?
Oh, yes. Of course, in gunnery training, we flew these little tiny planes, all the time. But when I got to El Paso, a big field, we were flying every day, up and down and around and over, just all kinds of stuff. One night we went night flight to Long Beach from El Paso. And my job was to send a message every hour. They called it a location message to tell my home base where we were, which way we were heading, and so forth. After we got my first initial message off, we used to get a message from the navigator, and then we'd encode it, and then we'd send it back to our base, our position report. After we got out an hour, you couldn't even get to base. So you had to rely on ground stations. They call them ACS, Army Airways Communication Stations. You'd send them a message. They would send a message back to your base where you were. And the amazing thing about it, I did it all the way across until we got to Long Beach, and I called them up, told them we were in Long Beach, going to turn around and come home, and I could hear them plain as day. So the skip distance in the radio signal got clear in Long Beach.
Wouldn't you know?
And then on the way back, every hour, I couldn't get my base. I have to send the AECs.
Radio waves travel in some funny ways.
Well, they hit the stratosphere or something up there and bounce, you know.
There's a lot of bouncing going on, and I enjoy that when we hear from listeners who are all over the state of California that pick up our signal here and there. And up where you live in Castro Valley, I know there's some folks who tune us in. Maybe they're listening today. Let's talk about heading overseas. They assign you to the 493rd Bomb Group, the 861st Squadron.
Yeah, well, what happened is the 493rd wasn't even formed yet. After we went to Salt Lake or something and base there, and then we were shipped to McCook, Nebraska. Now, McCook, Nebraska was where we formed the 493rd Bomb Group, and I was assigned to the 861st Squadron in that bomb group. I got this all in my book. It's all in there detailed out exactly what I did, like we're talking right now. We finally, in May, I think the first part of May, went up to Lincoln, Nebraska, got a brand new B-24J, silver, beautiful. Just shone in the sunlight, something bright. Oh, we were so thrilled. It was like kids getting Christmas presents.
And had it been dubbed yet? Did it have a name on the nose yet?
Oh, no, no. It was in fact, when you got in there, it was like a new car. It smelled that way. Everything was wrapped up in plastic. And so it was our plane. We were assigned to that plane. The engineer, he had all the mechanical, and I had all the electrical stuff, and the pilot and the rest of the crew had their stuff they got to do. And everybody did it. And so we decided we should give it a name. We had a guy in our crew named Cohen. He was a joker. He always kidding around about everything. So we decided to name the plane the Joker. So we had painted on where they usually paint those on the bombers. A big, it was a woman flying through the air and had like a Joker look on it, you know, with a, well, like a playing card. A lot of times they have different things with the Joker, you know.
With the jester hat and all of that?
All that, yeah.
Yep.
So our plane was the Joker, and that's what we went to Europe with, you know. First, we went to Manchester, New Hampshire, stayed all night, picked up gasoline, and then we were heading for England. So our first leg was up to Canada.
Probably Newfoundland or Labrador.
We went to Goose Bay, Labrador.
Yep.
And we were stuck there 2 or 3 days. I got the details in my book about what we did there. We got snowed in and so forth. And when we were okayed to leave, we had to go up to Iceland next. So we had to go from Labrador to Iceland, Reykjavik, I think it was, in one trip, you know. I mean, there was no place to land. And I had to make radio contacts every hour till we got there and let them know where we were, you know.
Yeah, I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes, and here you are, you're a 20-year-old kid, you're heading overseas, and you're the radio guy, you're the communications guy, and you're flying in areas where communication, it would seem to me, would be crucial, and knowing where you're going is crucial.
It was really scary. Here I'm a young kid, and I'm just barely qualified to send messages and stuff like that and communicate, which we did have some experience, but now it's real. I couldn't believe it. The Canadians were just gracious. But when we got to Greenland, I had to call into a British base. We call it a Limey base. And that was a nickname, you know, how it went, Yank for us and then Limey for them. But they always thought us kids were just stupid, you know. And so I got so embarrassed. This guy called in to make a report. And so this guy just poured it out 90 miles an hour, and I couldn't even get it all. So I sent him a cue signal, told him, please slow down. And then he just insulted me to the bone, like, you dumb kid. And he went, duh, 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 duh.
Morse code and slow motion.
He just told me that, what a dumb kid you are. Don't even know how to read code. And then he was real nice. He got straightened out and sent me a nice message I could read.
And you made it all the way across the Atlantic.
We went to Reykjavik, and then we stayed a couple days there. Man, it was light all the time. Hardly any night time at all. And you start to get morning about 4 o'clock in the morning, and we left there and went to Belfast. It was a British air base in Belfast, and we refueled there. Went by Stornoway, Scotland, into a brand new air base. It was called De Bock, and we were one of the closest air bases to the edge of the channel. In fact, they warned us Nazi airplanes coming in. They're trying to get some planes coming in. So, but we were lucky we got landed into a brand new air base.
Well, and it's that time where we need to take our first commercial break. But when we come back, I'm going to make sure that you tell us about the crew you were with and your very first mission, which came on a date that the whole world knows now as a very important date in World War II history. We'll talk about that when we come back. Don Miller, a former prisoner of war, joining us from Castro Valley, California today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Continuing our visit now with Don Miller of Castro Valley, California. He'll celebrate his 88th birthday this coming Tuesday on August the 2nd. Come December, he'll celebrate his 65th anniversary with his wife, Julia. But he never would have met her if he didn't make it home from World War II. And there were some days where that looked like some pretty significant odds against him, like all the days he spent as a prisoner of war. We haven't gotten there yet. In fact, he hasn't flown his first mission yet in our conversation. So let's get to that now. You heard him talk about going over across the Atlantic to England. And in June of 1944, there was a big buzz building. And I bet you were pretty antsy by then, Don, to get in on your very first mission with the 493rd Bomb Group.
Well, what happened, we got there maybe 15th of May or something, and one of the major things with a bomber group was to fly in formation. We had a lot of practice with flying in formation. It was very, very difficult on the pilots to stay in a tight formation, and you've probably all seen them on movies of the bombing and so forth. So we started bombing. We had targets all over England. We'd get us up at 2 o'clock in the morning, get down there and get breakfast, and we'd have to get down in briefing room, before 6 o'clock or whatever the time they set up, and then they would brief us. Well, they had a big screen up there, and they always had a shade down over it. And when the briefing officers would come in, this whole room would be filled with enough crew to fill 48 airplanes sometimes. They raise it up, and there would be the target for the day. We would go out to our airplanes and carry all the stuff that we had to carry, all of our heavy-duty clothes and stuff, get in our airplane, get everything ready. Everybody had his chore. We probably weighed, carrying our stuff out there, probably weighed a couple hundred pounds of stuff, heavy-duty clothes and boots and all that kind of stuff. Get in the plane, and we'd taxi out in order as we were practicing every mission. We'd get in order and come in single file, and we'd get all lined up, and we could take off one at a time. And then we'd get up, form our formation, go bomb, come back, go through the whole routine. We did that practically every other day. And on the 6th of June, we went in with the same routine. Nobody said a word that anything was happening. 6th of June, 1944. We all got down in the briefing room. We were so tired of this monkey business. We were practically all asleep. The officers came in, and they said, "Gentlemen, today is the day. This is it, boys. This is what you've been training for the whole time." They raised up the shade that was over the big map, and here was a place in France that we had to bomb. But this was D-Day. Today was going to be when the invasion started that we all been talking about, all been waiting for. I'm talking about guys coming alive out of their seats. Boy, we were right on it. And, we were trained perfectly. We went out to our planes and did the same thing as we always did. Got up, formed a formation, and headed for the target.
But I'm guessing the scenery that day was a little different than what it had been like on your training flights.
Well, as we was going over the channel, it was nothing but boats. I mean, thousands of them. Water all curled up behind the ships as they were heading for the beaches. Of course, we got up higher and got into the clouds and didn't see anymore. And then we didn't get shot at. We didn't have a gun going off, a fighter plane coming up. We were just sailing over there like crazy. And all of a sudden, the nose gunner in our plane yelled out, "Oh, look at 3 o'clock. And I was in the waist gun right then. Looked out, and here was a plane came right down from the first up the lead by the lead plane. Came right down just and smashed right into a plane in one of the other squadrons in our group. And two planes just disappeared out of sight. Motors, wings flying all over the place. We lost two planes, no enemy action whatsoever. 20 guys dead, two airplanes gone.
And that's, I guess, if you were waiting for a welcome to the war moment, that does it, huh?
Boy, that woke us up pretty quick. Then we did the target. We didn't lose any planes over the target. Came back, and we were fine. Didn't get it shot up too bad at all. A lot of VACAC, a lot of 88mm came up, you know.
And when you're flying in formation, your pilot has no choice. He can't try to avoid that fire, right? He's just going to fly right through it.
Well, we was over in the left squadron. So they formed like a diamond. They had a first squadron up in front, and the one in the back, straight back, and then one on the left and one on the right. And then each squadron had 12 planes. And we were in the left, I think they called it the left wing of this squadron. And my pilot, see, they switched over about every 5 minutes. The pilot watched that aircraft. See, we were on the left side of that lead airplane in our little three planes. And he had to watch not to smash his wing into that airplane. We were that close.
Right.
And then he would switch over to the co-pilot, and he'd fly for a while because he could see better, you know, because that plane was right next to him. And then they'd switch back to the pilot. So that was really tough on those guys while we were in formation, especially in a tight formation. The idea of a tight formation was, in case of a fighter, you had a concentrated firepower against that fighter from all the planes.
So you get back from your first mission. You've just been a part of one of the biggest onslaughts in world history and a momentous day, although maybe you didn't realize quite how momentous at the time. But you actually get back on the ground again with the rest of that crew. What was that feeling like for you? Because this is the first combat mission you've ever flown.
That's right, and we were debriefed. We all went in, and then the officers wanted to know exactly what we saw, what happened, and all this, you know. So that was pretty lengthy. And it was, you know, you were beat by that time. By the time you've been up since 2 o'clock in the morning, and I don't know what time it is we got back, but it wasn't, you know, it was quite a while. So it was debriefing next. Then we went back to our barracks.
Did that make you eager to go on another mission or a little?
I wasn't too eager. I think any of us weren't too eager, except my pilot. He was an eager beaver. But the next mission was about the 9th, June, about the 9th. We went up. It was an afternoon mission. That was awful.
Something went haywire on that mission.
Oh, well, it was cloudy, and our radios got all screwed up. We couldn't contact our group. We were trying to form a group to go on this mission, and my pilot, he was in a panic, didn't know what to do. And all of a sudden, we saw this group up that had formed, and so he took off after this group. Well, actually, our group had been called off, and they canceled the mission. So my eager beaver pilot, his name was Brewer, he had to go get on that other group that he saw. Time we got up to him, we were already over the channel, and we became tail end Charlie.
Which is the least favorable position for a bomber in formation.
We went over the target, bombed with him the whole thing. And then when we came back, nobody got shot down. When we came back over the coast, we pulled up alongside the lead plane and signaled to the guy. They knew we were back there. And we said, we're going to go home. But it was late in the afternoon then. In fact, it was way up into the evening, the late evening. We didn't know this until later, but a couple of Junkers 88 German planes followed that group in and shot two planes down in landing, you know, and they didn't have anything to fight with. They had no idea these Junkers were coming in, shot down two planes. But we were gone from that. We didn't know that at that time. And so my pilot says, oh, man, look at that castle over there. Let's go take a look at that castle. And he goes over here and he goes over there. And pretty soon he says, my engineer says, sir, he says, we're going to get low on gas. We better get up back to our base. And so all of a sudden it started to get a little dark, you know. And so he says, Miller, get on the beam. We'll follow our beam into the base. Well, there was no beam. There was no lights on everywhere. It got pitch dark. We didn't know where we were. We were low altitude. All of a sudden he says to Hampton, the navigator, get that gun out, that flare gun, and send a signal up of the hour and move so somebody will know where we are. And as we went on, all of a sudden a searchlight came up and hit us. Oh, it was like noon in the airplane, just for a second. And so we knew that somebody had spotted, and as it was, it's quite a story, but we finally, they put these lights, aimed them different directions, and we followed them. All of a sudden came a landing pattern. And we landed, and it was a steel mat landing field for fighter planes, British fighter planes. I think they were Hurricanes. Oh, did we get in trouble?
In fact,
we lost our Joker. So I mean, my pilot got really reprimanded. They took our plane away from us. It was our own personal plane. They gave it to the lead pilot for this bomb group. And we lost our plane. Third mission, on the 14th of June, they gave us an old Junker to fly.
So this brand new airplane that you were telling how much you loved and you know how pristine it was, and you've got to feel secure in this, you know, brand new piece of equipment. You've flown two missions in it, and now you're going out for your third, and you're flying something that you're not that confident in, that you've never been in before.
My engineer was so mad. His name was Guccinos. We call him Cooch. He was so mad, he tried to ground it. And they revved up the engines there, getting ready to take off. They didn't come up to par, but the pilot said, "I'm going in a way." And we barely cleared the farmhouse down the end of the runway.
That's not a very good omen for a mission, to barely get off the ground to start with.
It sure wasn't. In that mission, we got shot up. We got the engine knocked out and a couple of other things that made it start to get out of the formation, you know.
So this is your third mission, which turned out to be your final mission.
Well, yeah. We had to drop out of formation, and boy, then they tried to pick us off all the way across. And these 88s were blasting us away. We lost another engine on the right side, and the pilot, he yelled at me, "Miller, I want you to get up here." I was in the waist gun. "I want you to get up here and get an SOS sent out right now." He says, "We're going to ditch this thing. I'm going to try to get across the channel far enough to ditch it so they can pick us up." So, man, you know, I turned two right now. And the rest of the crew, had, you know, they heard the same thing, the three guys in the nose. In fact, I was going up to Bombay carrying my parachute in one hand and a dinghy and turning sideways to get through. If you've been on a B-24, pretty skinny there. And these three guys up in front, the navigator, bombardier, and the nose gunner, and they walked on the Bombay doors to the back because of their position to ditch was in the back. There were six guys in the back, four of us up in front.
Right.
So I got up there, and, you know, I had to climb up onto the flight deck. And by the time I started to go up, the crew chief yelled at me, "Hey, go on out. We're going to bail out." He said, "We're going to bail out." Well, he was off the intercom, and he didn't hear the pilots say we're going to ditch. See? But the pilot changed his mind. He decides we're going to ditch, bail out, because the second engine on the right side went out, and so he didn't think he could make it. So he changed the orders to bail out, and nobody heard it except I didn't hear it, but the engineer heard it. He'd sent the co-pilot up in the nose to make sure those three were out, and I bailed out first, and I never saw anything after that. I never saw my airplane. I didn't see anybody in a parachute, and I was about 14,000 feet.
It sounds like sheer chaos aboard this crippled B-24.
In my book, in my prologue, I got sort of a quick description of that actual thing that happened there. I didn't know where I was. I was way up there. I couldn't see anything. I didn't even think I was falling. I was in my parachute because I'd went right out and pulled my chute. Missed the tail back, you know, that 24.
Yeah.
It has two tails, and you got to drop below that before you pull the chute. And I blew. I was 5 miles out over the channel, and I blew 5 miles into France.
So you're thinking you're going to land in the water when you bail out.
Oh, yeah. I had this dinghy that in my hand. I put my chest chute, put it on, and I couldn't get my hands working right to get that dinghy hooked to those other hooks down there, so I just dropped that thing. I had a May West on anyway, and I figured, you know, I'd be okay. I'd still float. Well, man, I flew 5 miles into France.
I can't imagine what's going through your mind all this time, because at least if you land in the water, you're thinking, I've got a chance of getting picked up by my own guys. Now, as you start blowing over land, you have no idea what's going on down there below.
Well, I was sick. I didn't know what was going to happen. And when I got down lower, I was really moving. I was really moving. And I don't know how fast. I bet you I was going 30 miles an hour, 40 miles an hour with the wind. And as I got close to the ground and everything started to come up, I seen I was going to hit a farmhouse. I was heading right for it. I couldn't believe it. As I was getting lower and lower, probably two or three telephone poles high, this Frenchman saw me, and he waved at me, and I went over his head, a couple telephone poles higher than him, and I landed up in a barley field there. I didn't have any boots on. I had a heated flying suit on.
Mm-hmm.
And we had those slippers on with wires in them like your bed heater.
Because it's pretty cold at bombing altitude.
You know, we plug them in, turn them up, just how, you know, you get your feet warm and your hand, fingers warm and everything else, so you're nice and warm. I had my shoes tied on to my harness, my regular shoes. That was the law. You had to have your shoes tied on to your harness if you're in a flying suit.
Right.
You know, they figured if you ever got down on the ground, you can't walk in those slippers. And when I hit, you know, no brace for your ankle at all.
So you hurt yourself pretty bad.
Here I was. I rolled up on my chute and collapsed it. And about that time, the farmer and his wife and his little daughter had ran out there where I was. And oh, right away, they wanted that parachute. You know, they wanted that silk. It was a fence out there, and this farmer had a shovel. He said, we're going to bury that thing. And so we buried that. I put those shoes on right away, you know, so I could walk. Boy, my ankle started to swell up, and I couldn't walk. I had to practically hop. I put my arm around the farmer and his wife. This little girl was, you know, just laughing and talking in front of us, and we were walking back in the house. I was going on one leg, and all of a sudden, the way I remember it was that this French lady started to say, the Deutsch are coming, the Deutsch are coming, the Deutsch are coming, or something like that. She started to yell at, you know, and then I saw them coming. And so I said, well, they couldn't understand what I was talking about. But I said, thank you, and I'm going to get out of here. I don't want you to get in trouble. So I wormed my way, laying on my belly and crawling the best I could. And I laid right there. I got away there for about 2 hours, and they finally found me. Got me up, and they started yelling, "Hands off, hands off, hands off." I figured it meant hands up. You know, I stuck my hands up there, and they frisked me, and, you know, they were about 35 years old, 40 years old guys. Now here I'm a 20-year-old kid, you know, scared stiff.
I bet.
And so right away, where's the parachute? Well, I you know, we'd left where they buried it, and I didn't know how to tell them buried it or anything, and so they went back where I went down, and they found fresh dirt, and they found the chute. So they stuck the chute, folded it all up, and put it on top of one of the bicycle seats. And then they walked me 10 miles on that ankle.
Ugh.
Right across the country, not down a road or anything, right across the country. And we went right to a herd of Belgian horses. Boy, beautiful things.
What is going on in your mind as all this is unfolding?
I don't know. Here it is, early morning yet. And I'm walking. We finally got to a road, probably 10 miles. My ankle was hurting so bad, and it was swelling up in my shoes, and I didn't know what to do, and we just kept walking. We got to the road where they let me sit down on a rock, and we sat there for quite a while, maybe a half an hour, an hour, and here comes a staff car along pretty quick, and a soldier stopped him, and there was an officer and his driver. And so they put me in there, and I got on the left side in the back, sat down, and this officer was in the front side and the passenger side, and he had a Luger or what it was, one of their pistols.
Right.
He had that leveled right at me, and oh, man, my ankle just started to throb. It just boom, 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 you know, when it got off me. It got numb, and I didn't even feel it when I was walking. Oh, when I got off of that thing, it was just something else. They drove up to the first little village, and there was a headquarters out there outside this village. Driver got out, and there was a car already parked up in front of us into this. And so the officer went into this building. We sat there half an hour or so. So pretty soon a guy come out, and he got me out. Another soldier come and got me out of the car and walked me. I had to do one leg. I bounced, you know, just jumped the car in front of me. And I get in there, and here's another soldier in there. And I look around, and it's Cooch, my crew chief. And he was wringing wet, absolutely wringing wet. He landed in the river. He came out later, and I guess the plane had sort of came back into the land. And when he jumped out, he went into the river, and some kid collapsed the chute for him, but it soaked him. He had been in the river, and then the parachute was pulling him right up on the bank and dragging him. So anyway, I was sure glad. Oh, you know, I wasn't alone then. Here's my crew chief.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, he was wearing my private watch. Got ruined. I got a conversation after the war for that watch, too, by the way. But anyway, I had a GI watch on, you know.
Uh-huh.
So they took us into the village, put us in a little jail. And fortunately, both of us are in the same room. There's a couple of cots in there. And then these guards would walk out in front of you day and night, just, you know. So that's the first I ever seen of it. I didn't know what in the world it was or what we were going to do there or anything. They did bring us something to eat. Not much, but something.
How much of a difference did it make for you to not be alone, to have another member of your crew there with you?
Oh, it's just the greatest difference in the world. If you know, solitary, it's scary to death. Later on, I got solitary, so I know what that is. But right then, that's from being free in an Air Force base, now in a little Nazi prison. Oh, can't believe it. You know, every door on these places, we found out later, they have a stick with a couple of blocks on either end of the stick and a hole. And if you want to talk to the guard, like if you want to go to the bathroom, push the stick and it sticks out. That guy walks up and down. Stick comes out, he'll come up and say, "Yeah," and you tell him what you know, what you got. It's pretty international language if you're going to go to the bathroom, you know. And so I kept that stick out all the time. He'd come with, "Yeah," and I'd say, "Doctor, I need a doctor." And I yelled it all afternoon. So then they brought us some food, and about probably 8 o'clock that night, I kept sticking the stick out there where he'd see it. I heard a rap on the door, and a guy says, "Soldier." And the guy unlocked the door, the guard, and in walks this Nazi officer. And he's a doctor, carrying that black bag, the whole thing. And he says, in perfect English, "Soldier, I understand you got a bad ankle or something." And he said, I'm here to see what I can do about it. Oh, was I thrilled. I didn't know what, you know, I thought, now it's like heaven, you know. He took and wrapped it all up. He put potato peelings or something in that thing and on the ankle. And he wrapped it all up good and tight and gave me a shot of morphine. And boy, that was wonderful. I slept all night.
But the worst was yet to come, and we'll hear about that after this word from our sponsors. Hear how Don Miller survived prison camp and a brutal 3-month march when Hometown Heroes continues next on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. When we left off with Don Miller, who's going to celebrate his 88th birthday this coming Tuesday, he had described bailing out of his crippled B-24, being captured in France by German forces, and finally getting a little relief for his injured ankle from a Nazi doctor. After that, he was on the move to Brussels, where he would undergo his first interrogation.
They had a pickup with seats on either side over the fenders, and then you've probably seen them in pictures. They have a cover over the top, like a covered wagon over the thing.
Right.
With three or four, I think it might have been four of us on either side sitting on a little seat, you know. And we got in that thing, and we went all day long. Oh, it was a rough ride. My ankle was killing me, and they took us up to Brussels and put us in solitary confinement in a huge old brick building, and with probably a 20 or 30-foot ceilings in that building. And these cubicles were, probably big enough for a bed and a door and stuff like that. And you had room to stand up. And then they had it built up with chicken wire and barbed wire about 12 foot high. And no talking, no nothing. Everything had to be silent.
Did they interrogate you?
Well, yeah. During that, we were there 2 weeks in Brussels. And then they did. They took us up. And the bathroom was a can down at the end of the hall. But I got interrogated, you know, and this and that. And they told me they wanted all this information. I gave them nothing but name, rank, and serial number. Oh, of course, if you don't give us all the information, look at all the letters, all these forms these guys filled out. Look at all of them, and what are you going to do? I said, I'm not going to give you the name, rank, and serial number. That's it. And he said, okay, you probably maybe stay in solitary rest of your time here, or maybe if you sign up, and everything, you can go to a camp and have swimming pools, baseball games, and radios, you know, you'll have a nice time. But if you want to do that, they'll probably just keep you in some cell. So I said, let's go. That's it. Of course, it didn't happen. I went right with the rest of the guys, and then we got on a train. And scary thing, on the way down to Frankfurt on the train, we had a bomb scare. They had some bombers come over, and they stopped the train, and we were in this town, and they got us all out and took us down to a bomb shelter. That was real interesting. And then after that was over, we went on down, went to Frankfurt on the Main. We pulled in this train station, and it was partly bombed out, and all the glass windows were knocked out of it. And a lot of civilians in the station, and when they saw the Air Force coming off of that train, they were transferred over to someplace. A bus or something, I forget what it was. And boy, I'm telling you, that was scary. These guys were yelling, Chicago gangsters, Roosevelt gangsters, every kind of a name, Chicago, New York gangsters, you know. And we were shaking their fists, and the guards actually with bayonets kept the civilians off us.
Otherwise, the civilians would have torn you to pieces.
Well, they hated the Air Force, you know why. Yeah,
they were bombing them, sure.
So we went over to a little place, I don't know if it was an adjacent town or something called Wetzlar. We were still in our flying stuff, you know, whatever we had. And we got clothes, we got overcoats, we got hygienic supplies, you know, like toothbrushes and razors and all that kind of stuff. And it was like a Red Cross deal. It was a place where the Red Cross supplied people with the proper stuff, you know. The Germans, you know, went along with that pretty good. You know, because we were doing good with them in the States, and they knew it, see.
You know, we're running short on time here, and there are some key elements that I want to make sure that I have you touch on. Obviously, you're captured in June of 44. You're a prisoner till well into the spring of 45, so this is a pretty long ordeal. And you spent most of that time at Stalag Luft 4 in Poland?
8 months.
Uh-huh.
It was February the 5th, 1945. The Russians were going to take our prison camp. We had 10,000 of us there. Hitler had given orders, get them guys out. We don't want the Russians to capture them because the Russians were taking prisoners and putting them in their front lines and stuff, you know.
Right.
I think they took 1,000 or maybe even 2 guys out in some boxcars, but the rest of us marched. And in fact, we marched 3 months, clear back. I was liberated May the 2nd, 1945, a little town called Kittlitz. But that death march was a booger. I got it in my book.
We're going to let people know how to get that book. But how did you survive? I mean, 8 months in a camp where I'm sure the diet was nothing you would write home about, and there were guys who ran into all kinds of issues.
Yeah.
And then 3 months marching in freezing conditions with barely anything to eat. How did you survive? What do you attribute that to?
Well, on the march, there was no breakfast, no lunch, and when we came into a farm, they moved us from farm to farm to farm. So they'd tell the farmer, you feed these guys. And we broke up in groups. Sometimes we'd have 1,000 guys to a group, and sometimes 2,000, sometimes 500. And they would stop at these little farms and put so many guys in their barns for the night. They had steamers. They steamed, you know, sugar beets and potatoes, and they fed their cattle. So that's what we got. We got about 3 potatoes per night, and some small, some big, some lousy green-looking things, and that's it. So that's what, next morning, no breakfast, no nothing. Out on the road by 6, 7 o'clock, do 30 kilometers a day. It depended on what, sometimes you could do 10 a day, and depending on what you were walking through, mud, ice, snow, or whatever, through fields. Sometimes we were on the asphalt roads, sometimes we're on gravel roads. And, my feet, we get frozen. We get, for the first month, I don't think I ever had my shoes dried out. They were soaking wet, your socks and everything else. You slept in the barns, on the floor, right on the ground.
Well, and you don't call it a death march if it doesn't cause people to die. And there were casualties, I'm sure, just about every step along the way. So that's what, when I talk to someone who survived something like that, when other people didn't, when they knew the odds were against them, when they knew there's a good chance they weren't going to make it, there's no end date, no one tells you, the march is going to be over next week or next month. For 3 months of that kind of uncertainty and death around you, how did you make it through that?
I don't know. I think the good Lord had his hand on me. I know a lot of guys never had that luck. I don't call it luck, but this was a famous known march. There's been several books written about the march.
Absolutely. I've heard it referred to as the German Black Death March by some.
Well, yeah, some call it that. This one here, just a congressional record, the forced march of American Prisoners of War from Stalag Luv 4. So this one's just about our prison camp.
Right.
In my book, I have 11 pages of pictures, and I got other documents, maybe. I got 9 pictures and 11 documents in my book, and I have a diary that I had written on back of cigarette wrappers, which I have the original still, Pall Mall, Chesterfield, Lucky Strikes, Campbell's, and I had a little pencil, and my buddy, he kept it sharpened for me, and I'd write something down every day, what towns we were in, how many kilometers we walked, more or less what the conditions were. So I got a lot of it in my book.
When you go back and read that now, when you look at that diary, what are the things that jump out at you or really kind of grab your emotions and take you back to what it felt like in 1945?
When I even think about it, I think about it every once in a while. I don't know how we did it. In fact, people say, they read my book, say, how in the world did you ever do that? Well, I don't know. You want to stay with a group. If you dropped out, what? I mean, the Germans hated the Air Force to start with. You know, once in a while, you'd come into a farm to stay all night, you know, and they were sympathetic to the Americans, and they'd try to do some stuff for you. This sounds great. I used to escape it almost every time, every day. I'd escape, but not far, just far enough to get away from the guards where I can meet a civilian or a guard that was off duty. And I never smoked, so we got cigarette packages, maybe 5 in a Red Cross parcel. And I used that for money. It was like money. You just flash a cigarette at a German, and man, he was ready to go.
Of all that time, and when people say they don't know how you did it, I'm with them, and I think most of our listeners are. We can't imagine being in your shoes, as frozen as they may have been at the time. But was there one moment that was the low point, the darkest point, the scariest thing that you encountered, or the day that you really felt came closest to not making it home, not surviving?
Yes, maybe 4 or 5 days out of our camp. I forget exactly what the date was. We'd started about 7 o'clock in the morning, and it was icy and cold and snow. And we had walked from then till about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We was just at the beginning of this little village. We had to cross a river over there. We stopped, and we just sat there in the road, and it was so cold, and my feet were killing me and freezing. And then about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, a big truck pulled up, and it was just steam, and it was potatoes. They just steamed up a whole truckload of potatoes, and they started issuing potatoes, 3 apiece. We thought, well, this is something at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And once they got them all put out, they got us all in formation. They marched us right through this town, right through the town. Right outside the town was another big truck. And this guy was dishing out soup. And as we walked by, everybody had, you know, they'd save these empty cans and put wire around, make a little cup out of them you could carry with you. As we walked by, they filled our cup with the soup, and they marched us right on. We never even stopped. Then we walked, and every hour we stopped. You stop, you can't sit in the snow, you can't sit in the mud, you just have to stand there and stomp. Besides that, anything we had that we wanted to keep, like extra clothes and this and that, we carried on our back. And we walked, and every hour we stopped, and it got dark, and we walked into this forest, and we walked for hours into this forest, and I think we walked till about 10 o'clock that night, and we stopped. It got so dark, you couldn't even see the guy in front of you, and we were just dead tired. In fact, my closest buddy, John, and his name was John, Barley John, but his name was Ralph Holcomb. He recently passed away, but him and I were the closest buddies, and we'd saved some of this concentrated chocolate that you get in the Red Cross parcels.
Mm-hmm.
We promised never to eat any of that until we really were in bad shape, so we had to have some. And so we actually got the piece of chocolate out. And we walked on at 10 o'clock, and we stopped, and somebody yelled out down over the whole crowd. It must have been 500 of us, maybe 5 abreast or 6 abreast on this road. And he says, the commanding officer has, or commandant, he called him so, has made arrangements for us to sleep in this field tonight. So then we had a bed down right where we were alongside the road, and it was drizzling rain. That's it. We slept all night right there. Next morning, he got us up about 6 o'clock, I guess, 7 o'clock, started on. I met my Cooch. That's the first time I saw Cooch, my engineer. That's the first time and the only time I met him on the Death March, Black March, whatever you want to call it.
But he made it through too. And I apologize, we're running out of time here, but I've got to hear about what it felt like to finally, at the end of that march, be free, to be liberated and realize that all of that torturous existence for almost a year of your life was over.
We were in a little village called Kitlitz. On the 2nd of May, we heard a bunch of ruckus going on. Everybody was around trying to fix something to eat, you know, from what we had, what we accumulated along the road. And somebody started yelling, "Look, there's a fire." A bunch of us ran over there, and this guy, a farmer, had a fire in his barn. So we went over and helped the guy. And there was no guards around. I couldn't figure out how come no guards around. But we went over and helped the guy get his animals out. And we were standing out in the road, and all of a sudden, my buddy John, Barley John, started yelling, "Look! On the road," and we looked down this road, and it was eight British armored vehicles coming up the road. The front one was like a tank with wheels, and had a big gun on that thing, sticking out, a big cannon sticking out of the front of this thing. He was in a turret. So we all ran down there like a bunch of nuts, and it was probably 20 British soldiers and this lieutenant. And man, what a thrill. Boy, we slapped each other in the back, and man, they were passing out food, and they were passing out cigarettes, and all that stuff.
What, like I said, we're almost out of time. We've got to make it quick. But what, looking back now, and obviously, you know, to be free again, to make it home, to meet your wife, you have two kids, four grandkids, and a great grandkid that never would have been born if you didn't make it home. When you think about it all now, what are you most thankful for?
Well, that I'm not injured physically so bad that I'm in a wheelchair. I'm pretty bad in my lower body, my legs, and everything like that. But what a blessing to even made it out of there. I never could thank the Lord good enough for that.
Well, I think there's a lot of people that are echoing those sentiments right now. I'm sorry that we're out of time, but Mr. Miller, thank you so much for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a little bit about it.
Yep, it's all in my book.
Yes, it certainly is, and I'm very sorry we didn't get to hear more of it today, but if you want to read all about it in Mr. Miller's self-published memoir, Nazi POW number 2458, you can call him directly to order it. That number is 510-537-6791. Again, 510-537-6791. I also have that posted along with his address on our website, kmjnow.com, as well as the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. We are out of time today. Please join us again next week for another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.